Thank you, Henry. So I put myself down in the electrical and computer engineering department at Waterloo, which I'm currently visiting. But this is work I basically did while I was in Cologne doing a postdoc over the last few months. And it's joint work with Anthony Vannelli, who's also at Waterloo. So the talk is about a new mathematical programming framework for facility layout. And what this basically is showing that with a little bit of optimization, and particularly with nonlinear programming, we can do quite well on these class of hard problems. So let me begin by defining what I mean by facility layout. It's often also called floor planning. So the idea is we are given a set of n rectangular departments, and we want to pack them into a rectangular facility. Okay, and all we're given a priori is the areas of each department and of the facility. And what I mean by that is that the dimensions of the rectangles may or may not be specified. And if they're not specified, then part of the optimization is also to actually shape the departments optimally. And by finding optimal positions and shapes, to do that I need an objective. So the objective is to minimize, according to some norm, the distances between pairs of between the centers, in this case, of pairs of departments that have a non-zero connection cost. This is a problem that has lots of applications in various operations research layout contexts. The one we're particularly interested in electrical engineering is in VLSI placement and design. And like many optimization problems that arise in applications, this is an NP hard problem. It's a very hard problem. You can see that if you think that, suppose that the problem gives you the fixed shapes for the departments, they're all the same shape, and you've only got slots to assign them to, and you now want to find the optimal permutation of the departments within those slots, that's a QAP. It's a quadratic assignment problem. So in some sense, this is a harder version of the QAP, which I think everybody knows is quite a hard problem. Just to give you sort of a pictorial example of what the problem looks like, here's the data for a small problem, here's the list of departments with their areas, and here's the connectivity. So for example, department 1 to department 4 is a cost of 5, and so on. So you're just given a list of numbers. In this case, the facility I fixed to be a 12 by 13 rectangle. And given a whole bunch of numbers like this, what we're looking for is pretty pictures of layouts like this one, where we have, in this case, I'm using the Euclidean norm to measure the center-to-center weighted costs between the departments. And we want to find the best department, ideally. But in practice, we don't actually have an optimality guarantee. But we want something that finds good layouts quickly. That's the ultimate objective. Now, the motivation, particularly for our work in this area, is the following. If we think mathematical programming, there has been work done up to quite recently on mixed integer programming approaches for this problem. But the problem with these approaches is that the only problems that I've seen solved to optimality have less than 10 departments. There was a paper last year that solved, in fact, the 9 problem that I just showed to optimality. But it took them tens of thousands of seconds of CPU time using some fairly powerful machinery, to find the optimum solution. So because of that, most of the other approaches in the literature are based on heuristic search methods. So you pick some starting point, and then you try to improve by whatever favorite strategy you want to use. And then if you get stuck, you take another starting point, and you go on again. The problem with these methods is that what you find heavily depends on your choice of starting point. And the typical approach is to pick random starting points. So what we want to do is, in some sense, have a heuristic in the sense that we don't have a guarantee of optimality, but we want to pick good starting points. And here's how we do it. We're going to use a convex global relaxation of the layout problem. So we're actually going to relax the problem, study the structure, find some convexity in that problem, and then analyze what that's telling us about where we should look for for layouts. And then in fact use, so that's what we call the first stage. And then we have a second stage where we have another mathematical programming model that actually takes that as a starting point and finds feasible layouts that turn out to be quite competitive. So it's a two-stage framework based on two mathematical programming models. And here's the outline a bit more specifically. So the first model that we have is that convex relaxation. And the purpose here is not to solve the problem. The purpose here is to find a good starting point. So get sort of capture the global structure, in some sense, of the problem that we're faced with and try to find a good search area, really, in that sense. And the second model is an exact formulation of the problem as what's called an MPEC, a mathematical problem with equilibrium constraints, and I'll explain later on what that looks like. Another important point that we want to emphasize is that we can solve both models efficiently with a widely available software. So we don't need a special algorithm and a special implementation to solve these problems. We can actually just pick up black box off-the-shelf software and run it. So the first thing I want to introduce is the NLP method, which is an older method done for this problem. And here's what I call the VCCV model. The details are not too important. I'll just tell you essentially what's going on here. We want to minimize over XI and YI are the coordinates of the centers of the departments. HI and WI are the heights and the widths. And HFWF are the height and width of the facility. Here's my weighted cost of the distances. This is, again, the Euclidean distance. And subject to all these constraints, let me work backwards. So starting from the bottom, this is the area constraints. So the AIs are given. I have to have the exact areas. These are just bounds to try to ensure that the rectangles aren't too thin, that the dimensions are controlled. These sets of constraints here say that the individual departments have to fit within the facility. There can't be spill out of the facility. And these set of constraints, these are the harder ones. They're the ones that say that the departments cannot overlap. So the way to read this in English is to say that for each pair IJ of departments, if they overlap in the Y direction, then they don't overlap in the X. And if they overlap in the X, then they don't overlap in the Y. That's what this is doing. Okay. This is where essentially the hard part is. These are linear constraints. These are not very hard either. These are bilinear. This is the hard part, is the overlap. And we're going to have to revisit that later and deal with it within the MPEC framework. So the Van Camp, Carter, and Zanelli approach, that's the NLT method here, this is the formulation of the layout problem that they use. It's what they call stage three. So they actually have a three-stage approach, where in the first stage they try to evenly distribute the centers within the facility. So they don't worry about the actual shapes, just do an even distribution of the centers. Secondly, then they put in the shapes and try to reduce overlap. Then they put in the dimensions at that point and try to reduce overlap. And then in the third stage, they actually find the final solution. They actually find the layout. Yes? There's no integer variables here. Yeah. That's correct. Everything is continuous. In fact, I mean, in basically everything that we're doing, everything is continuous to avoid the problems of the exponential. If you try to do enumeration of some kind, then you're stuck. So we do everything continuous. No, it's going to be modeled with a bilinear constraint and a few inequalities. In some sense, it has to be integer, but we don't actually explicitly say integer. That's right. Now, the important thing I want to pick up here is not so much this final model that I showed, but the idea that in stages one and two, in these relaxations for the NLT method, the departments, to try to capture some of the information about how big they are relative to each other, the departments are approximated by circles. And so bigger circles represent bigger departments and vice versa. And I just want to start by writing down this stage two model, which sort of leads into the work that I want to present. So now we're approximating the departments by circles, and we're just minimizing the over the positions of the centers of the circles and the dimensions of the facility. Again, my weighted distances. And now the constraints say, well, again, bounds on the dimensions of the facility. The circles have to fit within the facility. And then the top constraint is the non-overlap. So the distance between the centers has to be at least the sum of the radii. This is, again, the hard constraint in this problem. Okay. So what I want to do now is start from this stage two, developing something that I'm going to call the AR model, which stands for attractor repeller. And in some sense, I'm going to get rid of this constraint here. I'm going to keep the nice linear constraints, get rid of this non-convex constraint by adding an extra term to the objective that's going to try to achieve the same effect. Okay. So now I want to introduce what I call the I'm going to build up the mod co-AR model. So there's an attractor repeller part. That's the AR. Then the co-AR stands for the convexification of the AR model. And then the mod stands for the fact that we actually make it non-convex at the end by making a change for computational purposes. So I'll explain to you how we've done that. So here's the steps that we follow. The first thing is we define what we call a target distance, and that's just going to be using trying to capture the fact that the circles have different dimensions. So we want to get an idea of how close they can get before they start overlapping. So that leads us to define target distances. This is the idea that I've mentioned. We're going to try to enforce those target distances using a repeller term in the objective function, an extra term in the objective. Then we're actually going to analyze the result and take one way, at least, of convexifying the result to understand what perhaps the structure is behind this. And that's going to lead to something that I call the generalized target distances, which capture more information about the problem than the first ones here. And then we're going to aim to achieve these generalized target distances using this mod part, the barrier term. Well, what I call a barrier term. It's not really a barrier, but you'll see why I call it that. So here's the target distances concept. So if I have two circles of different radii, Ri and Rj, the closest they can get before they overlap is the center-to-center distance of Ri plus Rj. So because I'm going to actually work with the squares of the distances to have a nice convex objective, I'm going to define the target distance to be the sum of the radii squared for that reason. And I'm going to add in this parameter alpha, which has to be positive. And this is going to be a parameter that's going to be used at the end for computational purposes, so it'll come back in the picture later. And so the target distance for now between departments I and J is just this quantity. Okay. So it's not necessarily, we're going to try to achieve these distances, but what the information they're really capturing is the relative dimension of the departments and how close they can get before they start overlapping. Okay. And now I bring in what we call the attractor-repeller paradigm. So the idea is the following. Suppose that I just optimize the cost times the distance for each pair of modules. Then we can think of this as an attractor in the sense that assuming the costs are all non-negative, then clearly the distances are all non-negative. And so a minimum for this quantity is if the distance is zero, so if I have the centers completely overlapping. So the reason I call this attraction is because if we assume that we placed all the circles separately somewhere and we just optimize, then they're all going to attract each other to a single point and just have total overlap. So we don't want such solutions. And so we're going to try to counter this attraction by enforcing these target distances using what we call repeller terms in the objective function. Now, the function that we use at this point is a function of one variable. It's just 1 over z minus 1 for z positive. This is by no means the only choice we could take. We've tried others. This turns out to be the one that works best. That's about all the rationale that I can provide for that. And the idea now is that for z, we're going to substitute the ratio distance divided by target distance. And the intuition is that if we happen to exactly achieve the target distance, then this function just vanishes because I get 1 minus 1. So I'm happy. If they're actually further than the target distance, then the 1 over z decreases, and in the limit, I'm bounded below by minus 1, so I can't go arbitrarily small. I just get bounded by a very nice constant. On the other hand, if the distance here shrinks very close to 0, then the term obviously blows up. And we have the fact that this is not allowed. Okay? So we view this as a repulsion, and now we want to balance the two. But first, let's just take what I had as the stage 2 and make some modifications to it to introduce what I call the AR model. So minimization of the weight and distances plus, for each pair ij of departments, the repeller term, the f of d over t. Okay. So now that I've added this in, I can get rid of the non-convex constraints here, and also these mins here that I'm just going to replace by nice linear bounds on the facility dimension. The purpose here is that now, and I keep these constraints that just say that the circles, I'm still working with circles here, the circles are within the facility, stay within the facility. Okay? All the constraints are now nicely linear, very structured. All the action is going to be in the objective function from now on. Well, at least for the AR, for the relaxation. So, it's probably pretty clear, but I just want to mention the reason we're not quite happy with this is not because of the constraints, is because this term introduces a non-convexity in the objective function. So let's look at that objective function and simply bring all the terms together, and we've got a sum for each pair of departments ij of this sort of term. So c times d plus t over d minus 1. And d stands for the square of the Euclidean distance between the centers. Okay. So it's a bit more complicated than it looks here. But now the rationale is very simple. If we wanted this to be convex, well, we've got a sum of functions, and we know that the sum of convex functions is convex. So we can try to just look at each term separately and try to capture what is the structure of a single term, and when, in particular, can we know something about its convexity. And as Mike Todd was saying, you need a proof. I'll spare you the proof, but I'll put the result up. This is a nice little fact about a function of 4 variables, a real value function of 4 variables. And all it's saying is I have a function of my x1, x2, y1, y2 of that form, where z is just my Euclidean distance squared. Here I'm going to assume that the target distance is positive, but that's okay by definition. I'm also going to assume that the connection cost is positive, and I'm just going to have to do something about that later in practice. But under these assumptions, then it's straightforward to verify that if the square of the Euclidean distance with this z variable is at least square root t over c, then the Hessian of this function is positive semidefinite. And if I have exactly a position of the circle so that z is equal to square root t over c, then the gradient is 0 of this function. Okay. This is quite straightforward. There's not much to it apart working out all the ugly algebra. So the idea now is to say, well, since if my distance is large enough, larger than this special quantity, root t over c, I have what I need, basically, in terms of the Hessian. I'll just keep the function as it is. Within this area where the distance is between 0 and root t over c, I'm just going to flatten the function at the value that it is at the boundary, so exactly at root t over c, which happens to be this value here. So now I've got rid, in some sense, of what I don't like, and I obtain a piecewise function which is convex and continuously differentiable. Okay? And what I can actually go and try to see what it looks like, and it's pretty much what you'd expect. If we look at the blue curve here, for example, here's the part where the Hessian is positive semi-definite, and this is the flat part. Now, I'm actually cheating when I put this picture up, because this is a four-dimensional function, so I've sort of taken a projection of it. But this is the idea of what's going on. And depending on your values of T and C, you see that the height of the flat part is slightly different. Okay. So now I can actually get my convex model, which I call the co-AR model, just by replacing the objective function with these new functions. So I have a different F sub ij for each pair of departments. I have a different generalized target distance. That square root is what I'm going to call the generalized target distance for each pair of departments. And I just keep the linear constraints that I had before. Okay. So I can do all this. But if you look at this, you can now start asking some questions. And the first one is, well, when do I actually achieve this minimum now? Well, from the structure, we see that the minimum value is attained for all the positions between I and j for which the distance is at most this square root t over c. But of course, that includes the case of dij being 0, which is what I didn't want in the first place. So where have I gotten with all this? Well, here's the little picture again. I have the part of the curve coming down and then the flat part. So anywhere within this flat part, I have the same objective value for this pair of modules. Total overlap is somewhere over here. Since I don't want that, but I want a minimum point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to aim for the other end of the flat portion. So I'm going to try to achieve a position where of the circles all relative to each other, so that pairwise I'm close to this area here of the function, rather than the overlap part of the function. Okay. So this is just putting on a slide what I just said. What I really want is a layout for which the dij is approximately square root t over c. And now I just want to spend a minute discussing this quantity. So if I achieve this, assuming I achieve this, then I have a placement, so a distance dij between the pair ij, which is still proportional to tij by some equation, by some relationship there. So in some sense, the original target distances aren't gone. They're still making a difference. Your choice of tij still makes a difference here in the positioning. But the c's come in. So this leads now to what I call the generalized target distances. And I just define them to be the square root of little t divided by the cost plus an epsilon for some epsilon small. Remember, this is the assumption that the cost had to be positive for all this to work through. So I just add a small enough quantity for this purpose. And if I define this quantity now, then I can think of it as a generalized target distance between the two departments. And why is it different? Well, the difference between the previous one is that it takes into account the old one that I had, but also the cost. And if you think about it, it makes sense for the following reason. Suppose first that the cost is small. So I have Cij being small. So even if the circles are small, so imagine that I have two small circles, then the original target distance is going to be fairly small because they can get close together. But because the cost is small, it's quite possible that they're actually far apart in the layout. So in some sense, this small quantity at the bottom is divided by a small one, and you get a generalized target distance, which is, you know, in some sense a bit bigger. This is all very intuitive, but at least to me it makes sense. And the opposite is true. Suppose I have two large circles, then the Tij, the original Tij, can be large, but if the Cij is also large, then this quantity shrinks, the original target distance, and it says, yes, these are big circles, but I really want to make sure that they're close together. So it's bringing together more of the information about the problem. And of course, it still takes the old Tij into account. I particularly found nice the way that this quantity just pops out of the analysis. When you go and look at the structure of the function, this just shows up. And then when you think about it, it really makes sense. So now this is where I do a little cheat, because I want to go to the end of that flat part, but I don't want to have to do a special line search that's going to find that. I just want to use, I just want to be lazy and use a black box type software. So what I do is I add to the objective term an extra, to the objective function an extra term, which is just the ln, the negative ln of d divided by this new target distance, this generalized target distance. Okay, and I'm going to put some appropriate constant k for things to work out computationally. This is why I sort of call it a barrier function, because we know this function from that context. This is not really the same thing, but it turns out to behave quite well in this context too. And if you go and look at this function, then the resulting function has minima that satisfy what I want, that the Dij is approximately the Tij. So since I'm really looking at a four-dimensional function and I want to plot some pictures, I have to cheat a little bit and just get glimpses of what's going on. So here's what I do, what I did to get the picture in the next slide. So I took two circles, I and J here, and I just took two paths for them, nice linear paths, and I parameterized the two paths with the same parameter. And then I just step the circles along following that parameterization, and as I go, I plot the value of the functions to see what's going on. And the result is a picture that looks like this. So in the continuous curve that comes down, has the flat part and goes up, is the original convex function. And then as you increase, so that's k equal to 0 in some sense, back the k that I had there. If I put in a value of k, then what happens is that this nice part here doesn't really change very much, but in the middle we get the growth due to the fact that they're getting close and that log term is making a difference. Pardon? It'll go to infinity if they cross, but I carefully pick things so that they don't quite cross. I mean, if they coincide, yes, it will do that. Yeah. But if they don't, this is what you get. You still get the effect you want in that sense. The ideal points from previously, the generalized target distances, the little squares here, here they look isolated, but in four dimensions they're not, because you can think that if you're at the positions where you achieve that distance, then there's a continuous way of moving them so that you stay within the same distance, right? So these pictures are misleading in that sense. But it seems to at least make sense when you look at it from this point of view. So here's the final product in terms of the relaxation. What we actually solve is so here's the capital F now, the function defined in terms of the new target distances, but it's essentially what we had before, plus that log term, and now just the nice linear constraints that I've had all along for a while now. Sorry? Not with this. If I take that away, then it is convex. This term here is sort of the cheat that I do to avoid having to have a special line search to go find those points. Okay. Well, b is the sum. B is the square of the Euclidean distance. So that's where the. I mean, it looks very nice, but I'm hiding things in the notation. Does that make sense? But if I remove that term, then everything is convex. So I could do that. I could remove that term and put some work into the implementation and do the same. What I pretty sure is the same thing. So that's the first model. Now the second model is, once I've solved this problem, assuming I can solve this problem and find a solution, now I have to use that to find an actual layout, an actual feasible layout for the problem. So for that, I'm going to bring in what I call the BPL model. And the part that I have to deal with is the overlap. This is where the difficulty is. So let's go back to these non-overlap constraints that say, let me remind you, if we overlap in the Y, then we don't overlap in the X. And if we overlap in the x, then we don't overlap in the y. Okay. Now, if you think about this for a bit, these constraints are really disjunctive because it's an OR that's really going on. And the way to see this is to rewrite them in this way. You either want no overlap in the x or no overlap in the y. You can have overlap in one dimension because the boxes could be one on top of each other or one next to the other. But you can't have both. Okay? So here's my disjunction constraint here. No overlap in one or no overlap in the other, which, since I've written them as inequalities here, I can just write as the minimum of these two quantities has to be non-positive. And this is where the MPEC is coming in. To do this without using integer variables, I'm going to introduce for each pair of departments two new variables, x and y, capital X and capital Y, ij, and I'm going to introduce constraints that say this capital X has to be at least the quantity I had and at least zero. So it's bounditable by zero or by the quantity that I had if it's positive. That's the idea. Okay. Same thing for the Ys. And now, together with these inequalities, I can write the min as simply saying that the x times the y has to be zero. So this is the one of the two can be driven to zero, which means that one of these quantities has to be zero or negative. They can't both be positive and this hold at the same time together with the inequalities before. So this gives me what's called an MPEC, a mathematical program with equilibrium constraints. And now I can really put minimization over the full set of variables that I'm interested in. Minimize the weighted norm. I can put, in some sense, whatever norm I want, as long as it's computationally reasonable. And subject to, here's the inequality constraints and the equilibrium constraints here between capital X and capital Y, the area constraints, and then what I had before. So make sure that all the boxes fit into the big facility without spillage outside, and then any bound constraints that I want on the dimensions of the boxes. But all of these are nice linear constraints, so that's not much of an issue. These are bilinear. Again, this is where the difficulty is hiding, is in the set of equilibrium constraints at the top. Okay. That's non-convex. Yeah, exactly. Because I have the negative of the absolute values, these are non-convex. It's got to come back to haunt me somewhere. That's where it's showing up. So in fact, this is a non-convex MPEC, to be more precise. But you can go and use non-linear programming solvers. And this is what we did to test the idea. As I said, we wanted to use off-the-shelf software, and we used Minots for this purpose. For a reason that I'll point out in a minute, this is actually probably not the best choice. But this is what we've used so far. And for the relaxation, for the Mod-CoAR model, but it does have an advantage for the relaxation, and that's because of the linearity of the constraints. The way Minots works, it has a quasi-Newton method built in. And so because the constraints are nicely linear, you can actually expect and get in practice, to my experience, quite fast convergence for that problem. And in general, you can expect, there's no guarantee, but you can expect superlinear convergence. This was the choice of K that we took. It was the sum of all the pairwise costs between the departments. Again, you know, the idea was that it should dominate the individual costs, but it just seems to work with this quantity, at least for now. Now, this is sort of getting back to the chicken and the egg issue. So I have the relaxation to find the starting point for the formulation, but what's the starting point for the relaxation? Well, it turns out that what we do is we simply put the circles in the following type of arrangement, just a big circle outside with the facility out in the middle. And this seems to work, and it seems to be independent of the permutation of the circles around. So if you go and permute their positions and resolve, you basically get the same answer. I haven't done a lot of experiments on that. I've taken epsilon to be basically 1/10 of the smallest cost, and it's worked fine. But again, that's not, it's sort of picked, and it seems to work so far. So this is where the nice feature comes in, where it's sort of independent of the starting point. At least as long as I start with arrangements like this, the relaxation basically seems to have a unique solution in practice. And this is where, so Minos for the relaxation is very nice, for the MPEG it's not so nice. And the problem is that the complementarity constraints, what I'm calling here complementarity, which is the equilibrium constraints, implied that there's no strictly feasible point. So that's pretty clear. And this means that Minos can't even start. It just gives up and doesn't know what to do. Now, ideally, I think that what we should use is another solver that can do with infeasibilities at the start and resolve the problem and find solutions. And people have done that for MPECs. And it seems, again, it seems to work quite often for these problems. But what we did was just a very simple-minded penalty-type approach. We took the We took these constraints that we're giving the problem, and we just stick them up into objective with the big K. So this is just avoiding the issue in some sense. The nice thing is that it seems to work. So you go and solve this, and it doesn't work all the time, but very quickly you start getting feasible layouts where at the optimum, the x times y really is equal to zero to within numerical tolerance. So this seems to work. But I really don't think that this is the best way to go about it, ultimately. So this model now, where I've sort of lifted these constraints up into the objective, is really our second model in the framework, is what I call the BPL model. And now I want to present some numerical results. But before I do them, just to explain how I can compare with previous methods, previous algorithm in the literature, I need to talk about what's called in this area aspect ratio constraints. So the aspect ratio for a department I is defined as is what I denote by beta sub I, and is simply the ratio of the largest dimension of the rectangle divided by the smallest. And the idea is you bound this above in order to make sure that the departments don't get too narrow. Okay. In fact, if you don't care about the aspect ratio or the dimensions of the sides at all, then the optimal solution is always just a whole bunch of very thin rectangles all lined up, and you solve the QAP in one dimension, and that's it. That's your optimum. So they look pretty bad when you do that. So this is actually important. Now, these are used in all the search methods, and usually also in the mixed integer programming methods, precisely to get a handle on what's going on. We actually didn't have these at the beginning, and it worked quite fine. But then we wanted to add them to really compare head-to-head with other methods. And because we're using nonlinear programming, it's fairly straightforward. To enforce the bound beta star on beta I, beta I star on beta I, we just add three constraints for each department, bilinear inequality constraints, or linear for the last one. So it's quite straightforward. They're well behaved. It's not a problem at all. So we can now actually compare results. So here's results for one problem, which is I think a very interesting example. It's the Armour and Buffa problem that goes back to 1963. So Armour and Buffa devised a heuristic back in 63 and set up this big problem and showed that their heuristic could find solutions to that problem. For this area, it's a very large problem. It's got 20 departments. And it's beyond all the mathematical programming approaches, the integer programming-based approaches in the literature. It's well beyond that. If we go and run our whole framework on this, one run takes approximately 18 seconds. But that's not the end of the story. You have to do several of these runs. And I'll get to that. And the reason is, maybe I can mention that right away, what the solution you get depends on your choice of alpha. So if you remember way back at the beginning, when I defined the target distance, I put a factor alpha multiplying the sum of the radii squared. And that's now essentially my search parameter. I'm down to a search in one dimension. I pick a value of alpha, I run this thing, I get a solution. And then I change alpha, I get another solution, and I'm down to searching within this dimension. So there's not one absolute solution that this method gives me, which in some sense is good, because if you think about a user that wants to use this for actual layout in practice, then you may want to say, well, here's a whole bunch of different possibilities. Tell me which ones you like or don't like, and I can go and look for others based on that criteria. So it allows you a lot of flexibility. That's the plus side. The minus side is that you don't have a guarantee of optimality, of absolute global optimality at the end of the day. It does depend on this last parameter. But we can certainly do several runs, use some simple search method on alpha, do several runs, see what we find, and compare the results with the most recent results for this problem, which date back to 95 in a paper where the authors were using a genetic algorithm to solve this. So here's the point that I was making. We don't actually need the aspect ratio constraints. We can just put bounds on the rectangle dimensions. So what we first did was ignore aspect ratio constraints and just put a lower bound of 2 on all the rectangle sides, independent of how big the area is, just a uniform lower bound. So you go and run this in with a relatively small number of experiments. We found a layout that has a cost of 4230, and an aspect ratio, if you go and then measure what the result is, of 6.67. The reason I need to do this is to go and compare with the genetic algorithm results. I need to have an idea of what the aspect ratio is to make a fair comparison. The closest result that I can compare with is an aspect ratio bound of 7, and the cost there is significantly higher. It's about 1,000 higher than the one that I found without those constraints. Then if you really want to compare, you have to start adding the constraints. This I think is sort of a nice feature, because it says you don't have to worry about the ratio constraints if you don't want to, and you can still get nice layouts, which doesn't seem to be the case with other methods. And then if we go and start setting these aspect ratio constraints, so here's the bounds that we used, uniform bounds on all the departments. Again, same methodology as the previous paper that we were comparing with. So a bound of 5, 4, 3, and 2. 2 is getting already quite a difficult problem, because everything has, you can't really have very thin departments anymore at all. And so it gets harder the lower this gets, of course. And as you see, these were the best layouts reported. This was with 10 runs of the genetic algorithm. This was with about 20 to 30 runs of our algorithm, with varying, doing a very simple search on that alpha parameter. So again, there's a very big difference between the results. There's a serious improvement on that previous method. It'd be very nice to know a bound on how low you can go, but that's, as far as I know, there's no easy way to know that. People have just, every time a paper comes out, people get better and better, but nobody knows actually where this ends. In some sense, the improvement. And just to give you an idea of what it looks like, here's the picture of the solution of the relaxation. So you get sort of an idea of where the circles should be, of where the departments should be, and then you go and solve the second stage and you get pictures where you get the actual layouts. Okay. So this was the one where all the departments have an aspect ratio bounded by 4, and again, the cost for this layout is 4,786 compared to the best one in that other paper, 5,700. So that's basically the point where we're at. I think there's still lots to do in this direction. One thing we want to do, being motivated to a large extent by VLSI problems, is now we want to do this and actually attack test problems from VLSI macro cell design, and really compare with what the people there have achieved. But the problem with this comparison is that for basic facility layout, we're done. But for this, there's also issues about the connections there aren't really center to center. They're from specific parts of your chip components to other specific parts. And that's really what the results that are in the literature are about. So we're going to have to refine our method and include some flipping of departments possibly and rotations and things like that to try to and get an estimate of the real, in that sense, the real connection cost to really compare. So it's really work that involves all these small but important details to make a fair comparison. As I was saying, this alpha comes back when we run the models, and it's quite sensitive in the choice of alpha. That's really where you sense the difficulty of the problem. You make small choices in alpha, small differences in alpha, and you get big differences in the result. It's very ill-conditioned in that sense. So I really would like to understand better how one might go about choosing this in a clever way to do even better than just a simple search. And as I was mentioning, also improve the way that we solve this. In particular, change the nonlinear programming solver that solves the NPEC to deal with the fact that it doesn't have a strictly feasible point. And these solvers exist. I just have to actually go and try them out and see if they make a big difference compared to my more simple-minded method to solve it. So that's the end of my talk. If you're interested in knowing more about it, the beginning of this, the ideas are in my thesis that I defended last year, and now we have a paper appearing sometime this year and a second paper that we just wrote in March with the actual layout results that I presented. Thank you.